Old as all of time can be, the root stands fast in the rocks below. John Sterling. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate all the support. If you're a new listener, welcome. And if you're a returning listener, thank you, as always. Voice might sound a little different. There was an update to Audible over the week, so I think my levels are looking normal-ish, but if there's a little discrepancy, I do apologize, but I think it'll kind of balance out here shortly. So I did want to go ahead and say that our usual October / Halloween episodes will probably not be happening this year. This is due to a number of factors, but mainly I have just had more history episodes to make this year. And when planning this season out, I thought I would have already finished Mesopotamia, and we could take a little break while I worked on everything else. That didn't happen, due to a number of factors, including I had that week off that I didn't want to take, and then, you know, other stuff going on. So, it's probably going to be put on hold, for now, but we still might get a bonus episode or two this month. I'm going to try and make at least one of those episodes happen, but it will strictly be a bonus. We are going to get our regular history episodes every week. And to that end, it is now time for us to move on to the topic of this episode, where we will be talking about the Hassuna culture and possibly as well the Samara culture. It's going to depend on, obviously, how long it takes to get through the Hassuna. Now, chronologically speaking, the Hassuna probably predate the Halaf and the Samara by a century or two, though geographically, they never reached the Levant, at least directly, and instead were bound entirely within Mesopotamia, specifically around the Tigris River Valley and a few of the tributary streams flowing west down from the Zagros Mountains, like I think it's the Little Zab River. In fact, they were direct neighbors to the Halaf, who, like we talked about last episode, were probably initially from further northeast from the source of the Tigris. In fact, they actually had some communities very close to one another, or see some sites abandoned by one group and then occupied by another, so on and so forth. Or you see slow changes of artifacts from one to the other. That's not to mention, of course, that there are other peoples that may not have fit neatly into either camp. People who were still nomadic, people who were pastoralists, or maybe even still hunter-gatherers just hanging around. But that said, the Hassuna culture was much more tightly compact, or at least the area that we found their artifacts is much more tightly compact than the Halaf. They don't push much further north than their Halaf neighbors, or north and west to their Halaf neighbors, and they don't go farther south than where the Little Zab River meets the Tigris, or and they don't go further east than out of the foothills and actually up into the highlands of the Zagros Mountains and the Iranian Plateau. So they're kind of in a little, very, or relatively small area. Now, I want to go ahead and announce it and just say that these are all modern terms and are just referring to a material culture. We don't have extensive DNA data, linguistic information, writing, etc. So we don't really know how close all these sites and peoples actually were, or if they even considered themselves one people, multiple people, or even if they even had a communal ideal outside of their respective towns and villages. We only have educated guesses. Now, with that out of the way, the first discovered site of the Hassuna material culture was discovered by Professor Fuad Safar. He was an Iraqi archaeologist, most famous for his excavation of the city of Hatra. The site is called, as some of you may have guessed, Tel Hassuna. Now, Safar made the find in 1942, and he partnered with British archaeologist Seton Lloyd to continue digging between 1943 and 44. And I couldn't get a firm etymology of Tel Hassuna because I couldn't find the specific site written in Arabic, but it probably just means beautiful or pleasing hill. And Hassuna means to be good in Arabic, so that's my guess. I'm sure it's a very simple translation. I also had a problem firmly finding this place on a map. I like to visualize things, so I like to look at places on Google Earth and other map sites. But there is a major discrepancy between where all the literature says the site is located and the geolocation tags on Wikipedia. According to every written source I've read, they say it is located approximately 35 kilometers, which is 22 miles, southwest of modern Mosul, along the west bank of the Tigris River. However, if you check the latitude and longitude listed on Wikipedia for both Mosul and Tel Hassuna, Hassuna is located about 21 kilometers, which is 13 miles northwest of Mosul. Now, if you just search Tel Hassuna on Google Maps, it doesn't actually appear. Instead, it shows up as Tel Magzaliya, and it is much further west than where the geolocation tag says Tel Hassuna is. So if the written sources are right, then Tel Hassuna would actually be close, I believe, to the modern village of Munira. Now, I'm missing a very simple explanation, but this just shows that you should always check your sources if you're going to use Wikipedia. But regardless of the exact location of Hassuna, it wasn't a massive site. It was only around 200 by 150 meters, which is around 660 feet by 490 feet. Also, despite being a couple of levels of settlement by different groups or over different time periods, it wasn't built up that high. It only got to around 7 meters, which is 23 feet high. Remember, tells are formed by years and years of buildup of earth and structures being built and worked on, and then, you know, they collapse or they're torn down, and then the land is later leveled again and then built up, so on and so forth. In fact, no Hassuna site was particularly large. They ranged in size from about 2 to 8 acres, and this means that at their high points, no Hassuna site would have had more than maybe 500 people or so. Now, despite not being particularly large, Hassuna, unlike Khalaf, was actually located around the center of the known Hassuna territory. So it's kind of like dead center in their known territory. But it is still unlikely that it was the center of focus for any Hassuna people if they did actually consider themselves all one group. It doesn't look like it's a major cultural center. It doesn't have anything that makes it stand out from really any other Hassuna site. And it also appears that this is not where the Hassuna people originated from. It looks like they originally came from the Zagros Mountains foothills, a little bit further to the east. And maybe even came further from inside the Iranian plateau and moved kind of west and south before they kind of get to their currently known range. Now, as for the people who lived in said zone, what do we identify with their culture? What makes them Hassuna, at least what makes us associate them with Hassuna? Well, to start, their homes were initially very simple structures. They weren't much more than dome, sun-dried mud splayed over sticks, wood, and, you know, with some straw kind of for the ceiling and to patch up, you know, holes. With some of those being placed kind of on large kind of stone platforms as foundations. And these may have only been semi-permanent dwellings. It's possible that initially the Hassuna were still very mobile when they came in, and still preferring to rely primarily on foraging, hunting, or raising livestock before they began to rely on long-term agriculture. Though, as time moved on and the reliance on agriculture grew, and it grew very quickly once they kind of got to the region, or at least they became more productive with it, foraging and hunting weren't as important, though they continued this throughout their history. I think they have a little bit more evidence of points and spears and arrows as opposed to the Halaf, where we mainly just see slings. So they were much more prolific, or at least they hunted with a wider variety of tools and weapons. Now, as that happens, their homes become more sophisticated, slightly. They're still made of the same material, but they were becoming larger, and in some cases, they were even given kind of like elongated entryways. Now, eventually, this would evolve into larger rectangular houses made of dried mud bricks, straw, and sticks. Now, inside the homes, they created plaster and made flooring. I don't know what kind of plaster. I'm assuming it was a simple mud-based plaster, though it's possible they had learned to use gypsum to make plaster. Gypsum plaster becomes incredibly popular in Egypt, Mesopotamia, Anatolia, basically the entire Eastern Mediterranean. And this happens fairly early, but I don't know if it was this early. And gypsum is also useful as a fertilizer, so maybe that's part of the reason they started relying on agriculture. They had access to gypsum. Now, aside from the fancy flooring, they would also wall off small parts of their home's interior sometimes to kind of make storage or work areas. In addition, some of their homes would also kind of have extended small exterior walls, like they would come out from the home and they would, you know, make little courtyards where, again, you would have little storage areas or, in some cases, even external kilns where pottery would be produced. Now, this type of housing was probably adopted by, or at least it influenced, the neighboring and succeeding Samarra and Ubaid cultures. And they would also actually make short pathways or simple roads between houses. And they also built these public structures that were probably granaries. I think they found grain in several of them. So at least some of them were granaries. Now, as for pottery, the Hassuna culture started with very simplistic utilitarian designs, much like the Halaf and other early adapters of pottery did. But this eventually changes. Like the Halaf, they began to produce more polished and artistically sophisticated pieces with animals and lines in a fine red or a dark black. That said, their pottery was typically almost always a white or a cream as the base color. And their geometric designs are almost always made with bold, straight lines, very kind of thick lines. Their animals were also much less detailed than the Halaf, at least in the pieces I've seen. And they don't quite have the same level of intricacy with like crossing lines and making quite as many geometric patterns. Now, this and the fact that the Halaf pieces have been found in Hassuna sites has led to some thinking that the Hassuna were merely trying to copy their designs. Though this isn't the most popular view anymore, and this is due to the fact that at a Hassuna site, it's an archaeological site that had a very early period of Hassuna occupation. Other cultures would eventually exist there. It's called Yarim Tepe, but at this, and this dates to around 6000 BC, or this layer of occupation dates to around 6000 BC, they found the earliest chambered pottery kilns. So it's very likely that there was innovation to spare when it came to pottery between these groups. It's just that it seems the Halaf just experimented more. And we talked about how they used a lot of different kind of clay and things like that when making their pottery that other groups just did not. But like the Halaf, the Hassuna also continued to make, you know, your standard, just utilitarian, nothing fancy pots too. They they would mix it up much like the Hoth did. Now, when it comes to tools, there's even more nuance to make note of. The Hassuna apparently used much simpler, at least when compared to their neighbors, tools. Typically, they only ever used flint or obsidian for their everyday gear. Maybe they didn't feel a need to innovate, at least when it came to stone. It may be due to the small populations at each site that they just didn't have as much excess population to work on this, or, you know, they needed more hands more often for agricultural or pastoral work. That's probably part of it, at least. Now, there is some evidence, though, starting around 5,700, give or take, you know, a century or so, that some Hassuna sites were beginning to obtain copper. Very simple methods, so they weren't gaining a huge amount, but they were gaining it, and they were using it for ornamentation, and maybe a small amount were used for tools, though that's kind of up for debate. But it's very simple how they're working it. It's cold rolling. This is the earliest form of working copper. But they are practicing it, at least when it came to ornamentation, jewelry, that kind of thing. In fact, the Hassuna had access to a number of more exotic stones than their neighbors, or at least they had access to more of it than their neighbors did. Hassuna's grave goods show a number of jewelry pieces found with what you would expect to find in the Middle East. But they also had a fair amount of lapis lazuli, carnelian, and sard beads in jewelry. Now, carnelian and sard are used interchangeably, as they're both silica and chalcedony. And they get a red color by impure iron ore that's kind of nearby. And there isn't really a strict definition, separating the two. But sard is typically considered darker and harder. Now, both can be found close by, particularly sard, and it is very common in Anatolia, at least at this earliest date. But I don't know that enough could have been attained for both the Hoth, the Hassuna, and other nearby peoples. So carnelian is probably coming from further east, perhaps as far as modern India. Now, this might seem a little far-fetched until you factor in the lapis. The closest known source for lapis to this region is modern Afghanistan, which is relatively close to India and to the Middle East. The next closest places it could come from is either Siberia or Southeast Asia. And those are both further away than India, at least to the Hassuna people. So small-scale, long-range trade through the Iranian plateau existed, at least to the Hassuna. And this also kind of supports the theory that they came from the Zagros. They might have had shared some level of language and culture with their neighbors to the east. Now, the Hassuna also used female figures, thought by some to be goddesses or a single goddess. There is another theory that I meant to go over with the Hoth. There are some people who consider these statues not goddess statues at all, but they think these potters and artisans may have been mostly female, and that these are kind of rough self-portraits of women. Like if you were to just look down at your body, you are going to kind of get a distorted view of yourself. Like you're going to see your upper part of your torso a little bit closer. Your legs are going to be stand out more, especially if you're kneeling or sitting. So that is a theory. That's also a theory why the heads aren't very detailed. They just could be a woman. So that is a theory, though I think most people do give the goddess or goddesses a little bit more heft when it comes to those type of theories. They also used stamp seals like the Halaf, though their seal designs were typically round or circular, and their designs in the circles don't have quite the same intricate or complicated designs. They may not have needed to have, they may not have needed a lot of different designs because there may not have been as many of them as the Halaf peoples. Now, another similarity the Hassuna shared with the Halaf, another similarity that they shared with the Halaf is that they practiced dry agriculture, at least mostly. Some of their southern sites were just south of the line where rainfall was frequent enough to support enough crops for population sustainability. Now, there were probably years where, just because you're just below the line, there was enough rain to grow, but long term, it wouldn't be enough to keep your populations growing indefinitely, or, regularly. You'd probably have a famine every few years, or at least not enough rain to support your population. So again, they turned to hunting wild cows and the like, in addition to raising and slaughtering their own animals. Now, after around 400 or 500 years, the Hassuna material culture begins to wane, and some of their sites in the north are abandoned and reoccupied after a century or so by the Halaf. And then another 100 years or so after that, the Hassuna material culture has been replaced completely by new artifacts brought from the south. And this these artifacts are associated with a culture known as the Samara. Samara, or the prehistoric site of Samara, was first excavated in 1911, it was excavated starting in 1911, and that continued about 1914, and that was done by the German archaeologist Ernst Hirschfeld. And that became the type site for the Samara culture. Now, as for the etymology, not quite sure on this one. I did kind of dive into it. There is a Latin word that is Sumara, which just means like... I think it's like elm seed or something like that, but that is a false cognate. The name of the city probably dates back to around 700 BC, give or take, a couple hundred years. The city was refounded as Sur Marathi, or Ur Suramadi, by Sennacherib. And this probably meant something like, and this is me just trying to use an Assyrian dictionary, probably meant city of some type of bird, maybe like a water bird or something along those lines, but I could not get a firm etymology. But that name has stuck, and just over time it has evolved into Samara. So that is a very old name for a very old city, though when Sennacherib refounded it, there had been periods where other cities had been founded nearby, but he kind of got the most recent version that has stood the test of time since then. But there are periods where there are cities either on that site or near that site that lasted for long periods of time. In fact, Samara itself, as we'll discover, will last from about 5,500 BC to about 3,900, where it's abandoned for a while, and then it eventually is reoccupied before Sennacherib refounds the city. So, but we'll get into all that later. Now, the Samara culture, probably started a little bit before the Halaf, maybe not as old as the Hassuna, but it is located, at least at this early stage, in the kind of the very middle of the Tigris River Valley. Not as far south as, the coast of modern Persian Gulf, but also not as far north as the Hassuna sites, at least not at the outset. Now, they did eventually spread to those areas, and they'll also spread to the west towards the Euphrates River Valley. They have a few sites there. I think the biggest one is known as Baghos, or Baghos. And then in the east, eventually they will reach the Zagros Mountain foothills. In fact, they'll overlap with some Halaf sites there as well. Now, right off the rip, I'm sure some of you probably recognize, well, wait, if it's that far south and the Hassuna were having issues in their kind of in their southern boundary with getting enough rainfall, how are the Samara getting along with agriculture? Well, they're the ones that, at least as far as we can tell, developed very early forms of irrigation control. Now, are they the only ones? Probably not. There's another culture further south called the Ubaid. They're developing their own irrigation techniques. I don't know if there's a shared connection between them, but it's very likely that to survive in the region with agriculture, you're going to have to do something. And that is one of the things that both of these peoples are going to be doing. They are going to be developing irrigation either independently or kind of in tandem with one another. Now, the irrigation done in this region is a little bit different from what you'll see in Egypt. The irrigation the Egyptians used was to kind of promote the fields flooding. The Nile floods very regularly, and it floods during the summer, like at the driest period. So it's a great godsend for people who are beginning to plant crops in time for a fall harvest. This is when they need it the most, when it is dry and just brutal. Tigris and Euphrates flood not as regularly, but generally speaking, it happens sometime in the early to, or I guess the early to mid part of spring, which is at a point where the first crops of the year are beginning to get to the point where they need to be harvested. So if the flood happens uncontrollably and that water comes in, the crops at that period are going to die. So the irrigation in Mesopotamia is used primarily to prevent flooding of the fields, whereas in Egypt, irrigation is used to promote the flooding of the fields. So that's just one thing to keep in mind going forward. Now, other aspects of the Samara culture, at least what appears to be unique to them, at their earliest periods, their homes are kind of oval-shaped, but as time goes on, they develop houses made of mud bricks, and they use that rectangular pattern, very similar to the Hassuna culture. However, as time goes on, they kind of innovate a little bit more, whereas the Hassuna culture keeps their houses as kind of rectangulars or squares, the Samara culture begins to do these T-shaped houses where it's basically a rectangle with a rectangle kind of like topping it, like a T. So it gives them a little bit more floor space. It allows them to kind of build out their walls a little bit more to make a little bit more intricate patterns. And in some cases, the walls are used to support parts of the roof. And later, these will actually be, there's evidence that these were decorated with what, you know, something that would identify the home or, you know, just as kind of like a maybe a ritual thing or just something to kind of liven up the place or kind of celebrate life, as it were. And this is an innovation you don't see, at least we haven't found evidence of it, in Hassuna sites. But this gives them a little bit more workspace in the homes, and it also means their homes are taking up more space and that they are even more tied into the land than the Hassuna were. Because again, there is evidence, at least at the earlier periods, that the Hassuna will abandon a site and move back later. The Samara, you don't really see that happen as often. So they're much more tied into permanent control of the land. And you can see that in other ways, too. Several Samara sites have walls, like covering large portions of their villages. Not necessarily squaring them off, but maybe covering the village on three or maybe four sides, but with some gaps. They don't have gates, but maybe gaps in portions of the walls. And the homes are all have fairly higher walls than the Hassuna did. So they're much more defensible. And there's a lot more evidence for conflict between sites, probably for control of farmland, which is something that you're going to see very well into the historical period. Now, another difference between Hassuna and Samara sites is that Samara sites take up more land. I mentioned that the Hassuna sites would be between 2 and 8 acres at most, whereas the Samara sites, the largest one of those, could take up 6 hectares, and that's around 15 acres. So the Samara sites, you would see larger populations to kind of go along with it, at probably around 1,000 on average, but some would maybe be a little bit more than that, around maybe 12 to 1,500 people. So Samara sites are, in general, larger. Now, they also, in addition to having irrigation-based agriculture, they also had access to a lot more fish fish and marshlands to kind of supplement their hunting and gathering. So they would get waterfowl, fish, all kinds of things from that environment, too, that the Hassuna and the Halaf did not have access to. They also had access to the same types of domesticated animals, sheep, goats, cows. There's also evidence that they had access to pigs, which in this part of the world, you know, were probably being domesticated around this time. Though there is some speculation that these could have just been wild pigs that they had managed to hunt or capture, though I tend to think that they are domesticated fully. Samara pottery, typically white. I don't think they used as much red for their paints. They tended to stick with kind of a black or brown painting. They did have animal motifs that you would expect, similar to the Halaf and the Hassuna, though they also had animals that were local to them. Scorpions, they depicted. They also would depict women dancing in certain poses with kind of like long hair. They also had statuary with women, and these are generally not thought to necessarily represent a goddess, because these are more in line with what you would expect a normal or a average woman or girl to look like. And in fact, they in some cases have depicted the women wearing paint or maybe body modification like tattoos, something along those lines. Another thing that stands out about the Samara, like pottery and crafts, is that there is evidence that some of their pottery has what may be maker's marks or artisans placing their own personal symbol on items. Now, this may be due to, you know, a growing kind of sense of individuality and personal ownership of property. Or it could just be something, hey, we share the same kiln. Let's just not get our stuff mixed up. it could be that. But they are also using stamp seals, very similar to what the Hassuna are using you know, kind of during during the same period. So there is probably maybe a little bit of both for this type of thing. So keep that in mind. In terms of burial, the Samara, very similar to what we've seen all over this region, people being buried underneath family homes in some cases jar burial, although I think that's not actually, they may not have been jar burials, they may have just been buried underneath the house. The Hassuna culture, I did forget to mention their burial practices, they use the same thing, burying people under the home, though there is evidence that they also bury people with their grave goods, and unlike the Halaf, neither the Hassuna or the Samara are destroying these grave goods. And the Hassuna may have even buried people with food, to maybe sustain them in the afterlife. There is food remains in some of these burial pots. Now, as time goes on, the Samara will begin to expand west towards the Euphrates, like the mid-Euphrates River Valley, and they'll also move up to the north and over to the east into the Zagros. Now, they get further into the Zagros than the Halaf did, but it's important to remember that when they're first overlapping each other, right around 5500 BC, give or take, like the Hassuna and the Halaf, this isn't an immediate, oh, the Hassuna are gone. This is something that takes place slowly over time. And the same is true for the Halaf and the Samara cultures. They overlap as well. So there's a period of time, not too long, but about 2 to maybe 100 years or so, where you could see all three in the same general area. And there are some sites where you will see pottery from all three that would have overlapped. However, the Hassuna kind of give way around 5,500, 5,400, where their artifacts essentially disappear from the record. Now, the Samara remain, and the Halaf remain. The Halaf lasts to about 4,500, and the Samara lasts to about 4,800. But they are slowly subsumed by another group working its way up from the south, who I've mentioned before, but this is the Ubaid culture. And eventually the Ubaid is going to cover a large portion of the entirety of Mesopotamia, and they're going to be the subject of our next episode. So I do hope you all will join me for that. As for today, again, thank you all for joining me. I was very pleased by the reception to the last episode. We had over 150 downloads, I think, day one. And also it looks like there are some new links available via RSS for other podcast platforms. Now, I don't know if they've already been posted there. Some of these sites I didn't even know existed. So it's possible they may have been posted for a while, but RSS is just now letting me know about it. But you can find all those on the RSS site. To any people maybe joining us from those, thank you. I hope you enjoy the show. I hope you will avail yourselves of the backlog of episodes. If you guys have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can comment on any of the YouTube videos, or you can send me a direct message on X and or Twitter, whichever you prefer to call it. Thank you all for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and I hope you have a good rest of your day and week whenever you're listening to this. And I hope you all join me next episode where we discuss the Ubaid culture. Thank you all. Goodbye.